abandoned his prize, but a stubbornness as deep-seated as his hunger drove him on. Sometimes the others helped him, sometimes they hindered, more often they merely got in the way, but finally it was done. The battered antelope was dragged over the lip of the cave as the last hues of sunlight faded from the sky, and the feasting began. Hours later, gorged to repletion, Moonwatcher awoke. Not knowing why, he sat up in the darkness among the sprawled bodies of his equally satiated companions and strained his ears into the night. There was no sound, except the heavy breathing around him. The whole world seemed asleep. The rocks beyond the mouth of the cave were pale as bone in the brilliant light from the moon now high overhead. Any thought of danger seemed infinitely remote. Then, from a long way off, came the sound of a falling pebble. Fearful, yet inquisitive, Moonwatcher crawled out onto the edge of the cave and peered down the face of the cliff. What he saw left him so paralyzed with fright that for long seconds he was unable to move. Only 20 feet below, two gleaming golden eyes were staring straight up at him. They held him so hypnotized with fear that he was scarcely aware of the lithe, streaked body behind them, flowing smoothly and silently from rock to rock. Never before had the leopard climbed so high. It had ignored the lower caves, though it must have been well aware of their inhabitants. Now it was after other game. It was following the spoor of blood up the moon-washed face of the cliff. Seconds later, the night was made hideous by the shrieks of alarm from the man-apes in the cave above. The leopard gave a snarl of fury as it realized that it had lost the element of surprise, but it did not check its advance, for it knew that it had nothing to fear. It reached the ledge and rested for a moment on the narrow open space. The scent of blood was all around, filling its fierce and tiny mind with one overwhelming desire. Without hesitation, it padded silently into the cave, and here it made its first error, for as it moved out of the moonlight, even its superbly night-adapted eyes were at a momentary disadvantage. The man-apes could see it, partly silhouetted against the opening of the cave, more clearly than it could see them. They were terrified, but they were no longer utterly helpless. Snarling and lashing its tail in arrogant confidence, the leopard advanced in search of the tender food that it craved. Had it met its prey in the open, it would have had no problems, but now that the man-apes were trapped, desperation had given them the courage to attempt the impossible, and for the first time they had the means to achieve it. The leopard knew that something was wrong when it felt a stunning blow on its head. It lashed out with its forepaw and heard a shriek of agony as its claws slashed through soft flesh. Then there was a piercing pain as something sharp drove into its flanks once, twice, and yet a third time. It whirled around to strike at the shadows, screaming and dancing on all sides. Again there was a violent blow as something caught it across the snout. Its teeth snapped on a white, moving blur, only to grate uselessly upon dead bone. And now, in a final, unbelievable indignity, its tail was being dragged out by the roots. It whirled around, throwing its insanely daring tormentor against the wall of the cave. Yet whatever it did, it could not escape the rain of blows inflicted on it by crude weapons wielded by clumsy but powerful hands. Its snarls ran the gamut from pain to alarm, from alarm to outright terror. The implacable hunter was now the victim, and was desperately trying to retreat. And then it made its second mistake, for in its surprise and fright it had forgotten where it was. Or perhaps it had been dazed or blinded by the blows rained on its head. Whatever the case, it bolted abruptly from the cave. There was a horrible screech as it went toppling out into space. Ages later, it seemed, there came a thud as it crashed into an outcropping halfway down the cliff. Thereafter, the only sound was the sliding of loose stones, which quickly died away into the night. For a long time, intoxicated by victory, Moonwatcher stood dancing and gibbering at the entrance of the cave. He rightly sensed that his whole world had changed, and that he was no longer a powerless victim of the forces around him. Then he went back into the cave and, for the first time in his life, had an unbroken night's sleep. In the morning, they found the body of the leopard at the foot of the cliff. Even in death, it was some time before anyone dared to approach the vanquished monster, but presently they closed in upon it with their bone knives and saws. It was very hard work, and they did no hunting that day. Chapter 5. Encounter in the Dawn. As he led the tribe down to the river in the dim light of dawn, Moonwatcher paused uncertainly at a familiar spot. Something, he knew, was missing, but what it was he could not remember. He wasted no mental effort on the problem, for this morning he had more important matters on his mind. Like thunder and lightning and clouds and eclipses, the great block of crystal had departed as mysteriously as it had come. Having vanished into the non-existent past, it never troubled Moonwatcher's thoughts again. He would never know what it had done to him, and none of his companions wondered, as they gathered round him in the morning mist, why he had paused for a moment here on the way to the river. From their side of the stream, in the never-violated safety of their own territory, the others first saw Moonwatcher and a dozen males of his tribe as a moving frieze against the dawn sky. At once they began to scream their daily challenge, but this time there was no answer. Steadily, purposefully, above all, silently, Moonwatcher and his band descended the low hillock that overlooked the river, and as they approached, the others became suddenly quiet. Their ritual rage ebbed away to be replaced by a mounting fear. They were dimly aware that something had happened, and that this encounter was unlike all those that had ever gone before. The bone clubs and knives that Moonwatcher's group carried did not alarm them, for they did not understand their purpose. They only knew that their rivals' movements were now imbued with determination and with menace. The party stopped at the water's edge, and for a moment the others' courage revived. Led by One Ear, they half-heartedly resumed their battle chant. It lasted only a few seconds before a vision of terror struck them dumb. Moonwatcher raised his arms high into the air, revealing the burden that until now had been concealed by the hirsute bodies of his companions. He was holding a stout branch, and impaled upon it was the bloody head of the leopard. The mouth had been jammed open with a stick, and the great fangs gleamed a ghastly white in the first rays of the rising sun. Most of the others were too paralyzed with fright to move, but some began a slow, stumbling retreat. That was all the encouragement that Moonwatcher needed. Still holding the mangled trophy above his head, he started to cross the stream. After a moment's hesitation, his companions splashed after him. When Moonwatcher reached the far side, One Ear was still standing his ground. Perhaps he was too brave or too stupid to run. Perhaps he could not really believe that this outrage was actually happening. Coward or hero, it made no difference in the end, as the frozen snarl of death came crashing down upon his uncomprehending head. Shrieking with fright, the others scattered into the bush, but presently they would return, and soon they would forget their lost leader. For a few seconds, Moonwatcher stood uncertainly above his new victim, trying to grasp the strange and wonderful fact that the dead leopard could kill again. Now he was master of the world, and he was not quite sure what to do next. But he would think of something. Chapter 6. Ascent of Man. A new animal was abroad on the planet, spreading slowly out from the African heartland. It was still so rare that a hasty census might have overlooked it among the teeming billions of creatures roving over land and sea. There was no evidence as yet that it would prosper or even survive, on this world where so many mightier beasts had passed away, its fate still wavered in the balance. In the 100,000 years since the crystals had descended upon Africa, the man-apes had invented nothing. But they had started to change, and had developed skills which no other animal possessed. Their bone clubs had increased their reach and multiplied their strength. They were no longer defenseless against the predators with whom they had to compete. The smaller carnivores they could drive away from their own kills, the larger ones they could at least discourage, and sometimes put to flight. Their massive teeth were growing smaller, for they were no longer essential. The sharp-edged stones that could be used to dig out roots or to cut and saw through tough flesh or fiber had begun to replace them, with immeasurable consequences. No longer were the man-apes faced with starvation when their teeth became damaged or worn. Even the crudest tools could add many years to their lives. And as their fangs diminished, the shape of their face started to alter. The snout receded, the massive jaw became more delicate, the mouth able to make more subtle sounds. Speech was still 1,000,000 years away, but the first steps toward it had been taken. And then the world began to change. In 4 great waves, with 200,000 years between their crests, the ice ages swept by, leaving their mark on all the globe. Outside the tropics, the glaciers slew those who had prematurely left their ancestral home, and everywhere they winnowed out the creatures who could not adapt. When the ice had passed, so had much of the planet's early life, including the man-apes. But unlike so many others, they had left descendants. They had not merely become extinct. They had been transformed. The tool-makers had been remade by their own tools. For in using clubs and flints, their hands had developed a dexterity found nowhere else in the animal kingdom, permitting them to make still better tools, which in turn had developed their limbs and brains yet further. It was an accelerating, cumulative process, and at its end was man. The first true men had tools and weapons only a little better than those of their ancestors 1,000,000 years earlier, but they could use them with far greater skill. And somewhere in the shadowy centuries that had gone before, they had invented the most essential tool of all, though it could be neither seen nor touched. They had learned to speak, and so had won their first great victory over time. Now, the knowledge of one generation could be handed on to the next, so that each age could profit from those that had gone before. Unlike the animals who knew only the present, man had acquired a past, and he was beginning to grope toward a future. He was also learning to harness the forces of nature. With the taming of fire, he had laid the foundations of technology and left his animal origins far behind. Stone gave way to bronze and then to iron. Hunting was succeeded by agriculture. The tribe grew into the village into the town. Speech became eternal, thanks to certain marks on stone and clay and papyrus. Presently, he invented philosophy and religion, and he peopled the sky, not altogether inaccurately, with gods.
This is the end of Disc 1. Please continue listening on Disc number 2. This is Disc number 2.
Presently, he invented philosophy and religion, and he peopled the sky, not altogether inaccurately, with gods. As his body became more and more defenseless, so his means of offense became steadily more frightful. With stone and bronze and iron and steel, he had run the gamut of everything that could pierce and slash, and quite early in time he had learned how to strike down his victims from a distance. The spear, the bow, the gun, and finally the guided missile had given him weapons of infinite range and all but infinite power. Without those weapons, often though he had used them against himself, man would never have conquered his world. Into them he had put his heart and soul, and for ages they had served him well. But now, as long as they existed, he was living on borrowed time. Part 2 TMA 1 Chapter 7 Special Flight. No matter how many times you left Earth, Dr. Heywood Floyd told himself, the excitement never really palled. He had been to Mars once, to the Moon three times, and to the various space stations more often than he could remember. Yet as the moment of takeoff approached, he was conscious of a rising tension, a feeling of wonder and awe, yes, and of nervousness, which put him on the same level as any Earth-lover about to receive his first baptism of space. The jet that had rushed him here from Washington, after that midnight briefing with the President, was now dropping down toward one of the most familiar yet most exciting landscapes in all the world. There lay the first two generations of the space age, spanning 20 miles of the Florida coast. To the south, outlined by winking red warning lights, were the giant gantries of the Saturns and Neptunes that had set men on the path to the planets and had now passed into history. Near the horizon, a gleaming silver tower bathed in floodlights, stood the last of the Saturn V's, for almost 20 years a national monument and place of pilgrimage. Not far away, looming against the sky like a man-made mountain, was the incredible bulk of the Vehicle Assembly Building, still the largest single structure on Earth. But these things now belonged to the past, and he was flying toward the future. As they banked, Dr. Floyd could see below him a maze of buildings, then a great airstrip, then a broad, dead straight scar across the flat Florida landscape, the multiple rails of a giant launching track. At its end, surrounded by vehicles and gantries, a space plane lay gleaming in a pool of light, being prepared for its leap to the stars. In a sudden failure of perspective, brought on by his swift changes of speed and height, it seemed to Floyd that he was looking down on a small silver moth caught in the beam of a flashlight. Then the tiny scurrying figures on the ground brought home to him the real size of the spacecraft. It must have been 200 feet across the narrow V of its wings. And that enormous vehicle, Floyd told himself with some incredulity, yet also with some pride, is waiting for me. As far as he knew, it was the first time that an entire mission had been set up to take a single man to the moon. Though it was 2 o'clock in the morning, a group of reporters and cameramen intercepted him on his way to the floodlit Orion 3 spacecraft. He knew several of them by sight, for as chairman of the National Council of Astronautics, the news conference was part of his way of life. This was neither the time nor the place for one, and he had nothing to say. But it was important not to offend the gentlemen of the communications media.
Dr. Floyd, I'm Jim Forster of Associated News. Could you give us a few words about this flight of yours?
I'm very sorry, I can't say anything.
But you did meet with the President earlier this evening,
asked a familiar voice.
Ah, hello, Mike. I'm afraid you've been dragged out of bed for nothing.
Definitely, no comment.
Can you at least confirm or deny that some kind of epidemic has broken out on the moon?
A TV reporter asked, managing to jog alongside and keep Floyd properly framed in his miniature TV camera.
Sorry, said Floyd, shaking his head.
What about the quarantine?
Asked another reporter. How long will it be kept on?
Still no comment.
Dr. Floyd, demanded a very short and determined lady of the press, what possible justification can there be for this total blackout of news from the moon? Has it anything to do with the political situation?
What political situation?
Floyd asked dryly. There was a sprinkle of laughter, and someone called,
Have a good trip, Doctor!
As he made his way into the sanctuary of the boarding gantry. As long as he could remember, it had been not a situation so much as a permanent crisis. Since the 1970s, the world had been dominated by two problems which, ironically, tended to cancel each other out. Though birth control was cheap, reliable, and endorsed by all the main religions, it had come too late. The population of the world was now 6 billion, a third of them in the Chinese Empire.
Laws had even been passed in some authoritarian societies limiting families to 2 children, but their enforcement had proved impracticable. As a result, food was short in every country. Even the United States had meatless days, and widespread famine was predicted within 15 years, despite heroic efforts to farm the sea and to develop synthetic foods. With the need for international cooperation more urgent than ever, there were still as many frontiers as in any earlier age. In 1,000,000 years, the human race had lost few of its aggressive instincts. Along symbolic lines visible only to politicians, the 38 nuclear powers watched one another with belligerent anxiety. Among them, they possessed sufficient megatonnage to remove the entire surface crust of the planet. Although there had been, miraculously, no use of atomic weapons, this situation could hardly last forever. And now, for their own inscrutable reasons, the Chinese were offering to the smallest have-not nations a complete nuclear capability of 50 warheads and delivery systems. The cost was under $200 million, and easy terms could be arranged. Perhaps they were only trying to shore up their sagging economy by turning obsolete weapons systems into hard cash, as some observers had suggested. Or perhaps they had discovered methods of warfare so advanced that they no longer had need of such toys. There had been talk of radio hypnosis from satellite transmitters, compulsion viruses, and blackmail by synthetic diseases for which they alone possessed the antidote. These charming ideas were almost certainly propaganda or pure fantasy, but it was not safe to discount any of them. Every time Floyd took off from Earth, he wondered if it would still be there when the time came to return. The trim stewardess greeted him as he entered the cabin.
"Good morning, Dr. Floyd. I'm Miss Simmons. I'd like to welcome you aboard on behalf of Captain Tynes and our co-pilot, First Officer Ballard."
"Thank you," said Floyd with a smile, wondering why stewardesses always had to sound like robot tour guides.
"Takeoff's in 5 minutes," she said, gesturing into the empty 20-passenger cabin. "You can take any seat you want, but Captain Tynes recommends the forward window seat on the left if you want to watch the docking operations."
"I'll do that," he answered, moving toward the preferred seat. The stewardess fussed over him a while and then moved to her cubicle at the rear of the cabin. Floyd settled down in his seat, adjusted the safety harness around waist and shoulders, and strapped his briefcase to the adjacent seat. A moment later, the loudspeaker came on with a soft popping noise.
"Good morning," said Miss Simmons' voice. "This is Special Flight 3, Kennedy to Space Station 1.
She was determined, it seemed, to go through the full routine for her solitary passenger, and Floyd could not resist a smile as she continued inexorably.
"Our transmit time will be 55 minutes. Maximum acceleration will be 2G, and we will be weightless for 30 minutes. Please do not leave your seat until the safety sign is lit."
Floyd looked over his shoulder and called,
"Thank you."
He caught a glimpse of a slightly embarrassed but charming smile. He leaned back into his seat and relaxed. This trip, he calculated, would cost the taxpayers slightly over $1 million. If it was not justified, he would be out of his job. But he could always go back to the university and to his interrupted studies of planetary formation.
"Auto countdown procedures all go," the captain's voice said over the speaker with the soothing sing-song used in RT chat. "Lift off in 1 minute."
As always, it seemed more like an hour. Floyd became acutely aware of the gigantic forces coiled up around him, waiting to be released. In the fuel tanks of the 2 spacecraft and in the power storage system of the launching track was pent up the energy of a nuclear bomb, and it would all be used to take him a mere 200 miles from Earth. There was none of the old-fashioned 5-4-3-2-1-0 business, so tough on the human nervous system.
"Launching in 15 seconds. You will be more comfortable if you start breathing deeply."
That was good psychology and good physiology. Floyd felt himself well charged with oxygen and ready to tackle anything when the launching track began to sling its 1,000-ton payload out over the Atlantic. It was hard to tell when they lifted from the track and became airborne, but when the roar of the rockets suddenly doubled its fury and Floyd found himself sinking deeper and deeper into the cushions of his seat, he knew that the first stage engines had taken over. He wished he could look out of the window, but it was an effort even to turn his head. Yet there was no discomfort. Indeed, the pressure of acceleration and the overwhelming thunder of the motors produced an extraordinary euphoria. His ears ringing, the blood pounding in his veins, Floyd felt more alive than he had for years. He was young again. He wanted to sing aloud, which was certainly safe, for no one could possibly hear him. The mood passed swiftly as he suddenly realized that he was leaving Earth and everything he had ever loved. Down there were his three children, motherless since his wife had taken that fatal flight to Europe 10 years ago. 10 years? Impossible. Yet it was so. Perhaps for their sake he should have remarried. He had almost lost sense of time when the pressure and the noise abruptly slackened, and the cabin speaker announced,
"Preparing to separate from lower stage, and here we go."
There was a slight jolt, and suddenly Floyd recalled a quotation of Leonardo da Vinci's which he had once seen displayed in a NASA office. "The great bird will take its flight on the back of the great bird, bringing glory to the nest where it was born." Well, the great bird was flying now, beyond all the dreams of da Vinci, and its exhausted companion was winging back to Earth. In a 10,000-mile arc, the empty lower stage would glide down into the atmosphere, trading speed for distance as it homed on Kennedy. In a few hours, serviced and refueled, it would be ready again to lift another companion toward the shining silence which it could never reach. "Now," thought Floyd, "we are on our own, more than halfway to orbit." When the acceleration came on again, as the upper stage rockets fired, the thrust was much more gentle. Indeed, he felt no more than normal gravity. But it would have been impossible to walk, since up was straight toward the front of the cabin. If he had been foolish enough to leave his seat, he would have crashed at once against the rear wall. This effect was a little disconcerting, for it seemed that the ship was standing on its tail. To Floyd, who was at the very front of the cabin, all the seats appeared to be fixed on a wall dropping vertically beneath him. He was doing his best to ignore this uncomfortable illusion when dawn exploded outside the ship. In seconds, they shot through veils of crimson and pink and gold and blue into the piercing white of day. Though the windows were heavily tinted to reduce the glare, the probing beams of sunlight that now slowly swept across the cabin left Floyd half-blinded for several minutes. He was in space, yet there was no question of being able to see the stars. He shielded his eyes with his hands and tried to peer through the window beside him. Out there, the swept back wing of the ship was blazing like white-hot metal in the reflected sunlight. There was utter darkness all around it, and the darkness must be full of stars, but it was impossible to see them. Weight was slowly ebbing. The rockets were being throttled back as the ship eased itself into orbit. The thunder of the engines dropped to a muted roar, then a gentle hiss, then died into silence. If it had not been for the restraining straps, Floyd would have floated out of his seat. His stomach felt as if it was going to do so anyway. He hoped that the pills he had been given half an hour and 10,000 miles ago would perform as per specifications. He had been spacesick just once in his career, and that was much too often. The pilot's voice was firm and confident as it came over the cabin speaker.
"Please observe all zero-G regulations. We will be docking at Space Station 1 in 45 minutes.
The stewardess came walking up the narrow corridor to the right of the closely spaced seats. There was a slight buoyancy about her steps, and her feet came away from the floor reluctantly, as if entangled in glue. She was keeping to the bright yellow band of Velcro carpeting that ran the full length of the floor and of the ceiling. The carpet and the soles of her sandals were covered with myriads of tiny hooks so that they clung together like burrs. This trick of walking in free fall was immensely reassuring to disoriented passengers.
"Would you like some coffee or tea, Dr. Floyd?" she asked cheerfully.
"No, thank you," he smiled. He
He always felt like a baby when he had to suck at one of those plastic drinking tubes. The stewardess was still hovering anxiously around him as he popped open his briefcase and prepared to remove his papers.
Dr. Floyd, may I ask you a question?
Certainly, he answered, looking up over his glasses. My fiancée is a geologist at Clavius, said Miss Simmons, measuring her words carefully, and I haven't heard from him for over a week.
I'm sorry to hear that. Maybe he's away from his base and out of touch.
She shook her head.
He always tells me when that's going to happen, and you can imagine how worried I am with all these rumors. Is it really true about an epidemic on the moon?
If it is, there's no cause for alarm. Remember, there was a quarantine back in 98 over that mutated flu virus? A lot of people were sick, but no one died. And that's really all I can say, he concluded firmly.
Miss Simmons smiled pleasantly and straightened up.
Well, thank you anyway, Doctor. I'm sorry to have bothered you.
No bother at all, he said gallantly, but not very accurately.
Then he buried himself in his endless technical reports in a desperate last-minute assault on the usual backlog. He would have no time for reading when he got to the moon. Chapter 8. Orbital Rendezvous. Half an hour later, the pilot announced,
"We make contact in 10 minutes. Please check your seat harness."
Floyd obeyed and put away his papers. It was asking for trouble to read during the celestial juggling act which took place during the last 300 miles. Best to close one's eyes and relax while the spacecraft was nudged back and forth with brief bursts of rocket power. A few minutes later, he caught his first glimpse of Space Station 1, only a few miles away. The sunlight glinted and sparkled from the polished metal surfaces of the slowly revolving 300-yard diameter disk. Not far away, drifting in the same orbit, was a swept-back Titov 5 spaceplane, and close to that an almost spherical Ares 1B, the workhorse of space, with the four stubby legs of its lunar landing shock absorbers jutting from one side. The Orion 3 spacecraft was descending from a higher orbit, which brought the Earth into spectacular view behind the station. From his altitude of 200 miles, Floyd could see much of Africa and the Atlantic Ocean. There was considerable cloud cover, but he could still detect the blue-green outlines of the Gold Coast. The central axis of the space station, with its docking arms extended, was now slowly swimming toward them. Unlike the structure from which it sprang, it was not rotating. Or rather, it was running in reverse at a rate which exactly countered the station's own spin. Thus, a visiting spacecraft could be coupled to it for the transfer of personnel or cargo without being whirled disastrously around. With the softest of thuds, ship and station made contact. There were metallic, scratching noises from outside, then the brief hissing of air as pressures equalized. A few seconds later, the airlock door opened, and a man wearing the light, close-fitting slacks and short-sleeved shirt, which was almost the uniform of space station personnel, came into the cabin.
"Pleased to meet you, Dr. Floyd. I'm Nick Miller, station security. I'm to look after you until the shuttle leaves."
They shook hands, then Floyd smiled at the stewardess and said,
"Please give my compliments to Captain Tynes and thank him for the smooth ride. Perhaps I'll see you on the way home."
Very cautiously, it was more than a year since he had last been weightless, and it would be some time before he regained his space legs, he hauled himself hand over hand through the airlock and into the large circular chamber at the axis of the space station. It was a heavily padded room, its walls covered with recessed handholds. Floyd gripped one of these firmly while the whole chamber started to rotate until it matched the spin of the station. As it gained speed, faint and ghostly gravitational fingers began to clutch at him, and he drifted slowly toward the circular wall. Now he was standing, swaying back and forth gently like seaweed in the surge of the tide, on what had magically become a curving floor. The centrifugal force of the station's spin had taken hold of him. It was very feeble here, so near the axis, but would increase steadily as he moved outward. From the central transit chamber, he followed Miller down a curving stair. At first his weight was so slight that he had almost to force himself downward by holding onto the handrail. Not until he reached the passenger lounge and the outer skin of the great revolving disc had he acquired enough weight to move around almost normally. The lounge had been redecorated since his last visit and had acquired several new facilities. Besides the usual chairs, small tables, restaurant, and post office, there were now a barber shop, drugstore, movie theater, and a souvenir shop selling photographs and slides of lunar and planetary landscapes, guaranteed genuine pieces of Lunix, Rangers, and Surveyors, all neatly mounted in plastic and exorbitantly priced.
"Can I get you anything while we're waiting?" Miller asked. "We board in about 30 minutes.
"I could do with a cup of black coffee, 2 lumps, and I'd like to call Earth."
"Right, Doctor. I'll get the coffee. The phones are over there."
The picturesque booths were only a few yards from a barrier with two entrances labeled "Welcome to the U.S. Section" and "Welcome to the Soviet Section." Beneath these were notices which read in English, Russian and Chinese, French, German and Spanish, "Please have ready your passport, visa, medical certificate, transportation permit, weight declaration." There was a rather pleasant symbolism about the fact that as soon as they had passed through the barriers, in either direction, passengers were free to mix again. The division was purely for administrative purposes. Floyd, after checking that the area code for the United States was still 81, punched his 12-digit home number, dropped his plastic all-purpose credit card into the pay slot, and was through in 30 seconds. Washington was still sleeping, for it was several hours to dawn, but he would not disturb anyone. His housekeeper would get the message from the recorder as soon as she awoke.
"Miss Fleming, this is Dr. Floyd. Sorry I had to leave in such a hurry. Would you please call my office and ask them to collect the car? It's at Dulles Airport, and the key is with Mr. Bailey, Senior Flight Control Officer. Next, will you call the Chevy Chase Country Club and leave a message for the secretary? I definitely won't be able to play in the tennis tournament next weekend. Give my apologies. I'm afraid they were counting on me. Then call Downtown Electronics and tell them that if the video in my study isn't fixed by, Wednesday, they can take the damn thing back." He paused for breath and tried to think of any other crises or problems that might arise during the days ahead. "If you run short of cash, speak to the office. They can get urgent messages to me, but I may be too busy to answer. I give my love to the children and say I'll be back as soon as I can. Oh, hell, here's someone I don't want to see. I'll call from the moon if I can. Goodbye." Floyd tried to duck out of the booth, but it was too late. He had already been spotted. Bearing down on him through the Soviet section exit was Dr. Dmitri Moisevich of the USSR Academy of Science. Dmitri was one of Floyd's best friends, and for that very reason, he was the last person he wished to talk to here and now. Chapter 9. Moon Shuttle. The Russian astronomer was tall, slender, and blonde, and his unlined face belied his 55 years, the last 10 of which had been spent building up the giant radio observatory on the far side of the moon, where 2,000 miles of solid rock would shield it from the electronic racket of Earth.
"Why, Heywood," he said, shaking hands firmly, "it's a small universe. How are you? And your charming children?"
"We're fine," Floyd replied warmly, but with a slightly distracted air. "We often talk about the wonderful time you gave us last summer." He was sorry he could not sound more sincere. They really had enjoyed a week's vacation in Odessa with Dmitri during one of the Russians' visits to Earth.
"And you? I suppose you are on your way up?" Dmitri inquired.
Yes, my flight leaves in half an hour," answered Floyd.
"Do you know Mr. Miller?"
The security officer had now approached and was standing at a respectful distance holding a plastic cup full of coffee.
"Of course. But please put that down, Mr. Miller. This is Dr. Floyd's last chance to have a civilized drink. Let's not waste it. I insist."
They followed Dmitri out of the main lounge into the observation section and soon were sitting at a table under a dim light watching the moving panorama of the stars. Space Station 1 revolved once a minute, and the centrifugal force generated by this slow spin produced an artificial gravity equal to the moon's. This, it had been discovered, was a good compromise between Earth gravity and no gravity at all. Moreover, it gave moon-bound passengers a chance to become acclimatized. Outside the almost invisible windows, Earth and stars marched in a silent procession. At the moment, this side of the station was tilted away from the sun. Otherwise, it would have been impossible to look out, for the lounge would have been blasted with light. Even as it was, the glare of the Earth, filling half the sky, drowned all but the brighter stars. But Earth was waning as the station orbited toward the night side of the planet. In a few minutes, it would be a huge black disk spangled with the lights of cities, and then the sky would belong to the stars.
Now,
said Dmitri, after he had swiftly downed his first drink and was toying with the second.
What's all this about an epidemic in the U.S. sector? I wanted to go there on this trip. No, Professor, they told me. We're very sorry, but there's a strict quarantine until further notice. I pulled all the strings I could. It was no use. Now you, tell me what's happening.
Floyd groaned inwardly. Here we go again, he thought. The sooner I'm on that shuttle, headed for the moon, the happier I'll be.
The quarantine is purely a safety precaution, he said cautiously. We're not even sure it's really necessary, but we don't believe in taking chances.
But what is the disease? What are the symptoms? Could it be extraterrestrial? Do you want any help from our medical services?
I'm sorry, Dmitri. We've been asked not to say anything at the moment. Thanks for the offer, but we can handle the situation.
Said Moisevich, obviously quite unconvinced. Seems odd to me that you, an astronomer, should be sent up to the moon to look into an epidemic.
I'm only an ex-astronomer. It's years since I did any real research. Now I'm a scientific expert.
That means I know nothing about absolutely everything. Then, do you know what TMA-1 means?
Miller seemed about to choke on his drink, but Floyd was made of sterner stuff. He looked his old friend straight in the eye and said calmly,
TMA-1? What an odd expression. Where did you hear it?
Never mind, retorted the Russian. You can't fool me. But if you've run into something you can't handle, I hope you don't leave it until too late before you yell for help.
Miller looked meaningfully at his watch.
Due to board in 5 minutes, Dr. Floyd, he said. I think we'd better get moving.
Though he knew that they still had a good 20 minutes, Floyd got up with haste. Too much haste, for he had forgotten the 1/6 of a gravity. He grabbed the table just in time to prevent a takeoff.
It was fine meeting with you, Dmitri, he said, not quite accurately. Hope you have a good trip down to Earth. I'll give you a call as soon as I'm back.
As they left the lounge and checked through the U.S. transit barrier, Floyd remarked,
Phew, that was close. Thanks for rescuing me.
You know, Doctor, said the security officer, I hope he isn't right.
Right about what?
About us running into something we can't handle?
That, Floyd answered with determination, is what I intend to find out.
45 minutes later, the Ares 1B lunar carrier pulled away from the station. There was none of the power and fury of a takeoff from Earth, only an almost inaudible, far-off whistling as the low-thrust plasma jets blasted their electrified streams into space. The gentle push lasted for more than 15 minutes, and the mild acceleration would not have prevented anyone from moving around the cabin. But when it was over, the ship was no longer bound to Earth, as it had been while it still accompanied the station. It had broken the bonds of gravity, and was now a free and independent planet, circling the sun in an orbit of its own. The cabin Floyd now had all to himself had been designed for 30 passengers. It was strange and rather lonely to see all the empty seats around him, and to have the undivided attention of the steward and stewardess, not to mention pilot, co-pilot, and 2 engineers. He doubted that any man in history had ever received such exclusive service, and it was most unlikely that anyone would do so in the future. He recalled the cynical remark of one of the less reputable pontiffs.
Now that we have the papacy, let us enjoy it.
Well, he would enjoy this trip and the euphoria of weightlessness. With the loss of gravity, he had, at least for a while, shed most of his cares. Someone had once said that you could be terrified in space, but you could not be worried there. It was perfectly true. The stewards, it appeared, were determined to make him eat for the whole 25 hours of the trip, and he was continually fending off unwanted meals. Eating in zero gravity was no real problem, contrary to the dark forebodings of the early astronauts. He sat at an ordinary table, to which the plates were clipped, as aboard ship in a rough sea. All the courses had some element of stickiness, so that they would not take off and go wandering around the cabin. Thus, a chop would be glued to the plate by a thick sauce, and a salad kept under control by an adhesive dressing. With a little skill and care, there were few items that could not be tackled safely. The only things banned were hot soups and excessively crumbly pastries. Drinks, of course, were a different matter. All liquids simply had to be kept in plastic squeeze bottles. A whole generation of research by heroic but unsung volunteers had gone into the design of the washroom, and it was now considered to be more or less foolproof. Floyd investigated it soon after freefall had begun. He found himself in a little cubicle with all the fittings of an ordinary airline toilet, but illuminated with a red light that was very harsh and unpleasant to the eye. A notice printed in prominent letters announced, "Most important, for your own comfort, please read these instructions carefully." Floyd sat down, one still tended to do so even when weightless, and read the notice several times. When he was sure that there had been no modification since his last trip, he pressed the start button. Close at hand, an electric motor began to whir, and Floyd felt himself moving. As the notice advised him to do, he closed his eyes and waited. After a minute, a bell chimed softly, and he looked around. The light had now changed to a soothing pinkish white, but more important, he was under gravity again. Only the faintest vibration revealed that it was spurious gravity caused by the carousel-like spin of the whole toilet compartment. Floyd picked up a piece of soap and watched it drop in slow motion. He judged that the centrifugal force was about a quarter of a normal gravity. But that was quite enough. It would ensure that everything moved in the right direction, in the one place where this mattered most. He pressed the stop for exit button and closed his eyes again. Weight slowly ebbed as the rotation ceased. The bell gave a double chime, and the red warning light was back. The door was then locked in the right position to let him glide out into the cabin, where he adhered as quickly as possible to the carpet. He had long ago exhausted the novelty of weightlessness and was grateful for the Velcro slippers that allowed him to walk almost normally. There was plenty to occupy his time, even if he did nothing but sit and read. When he tired of official reports and memoranda and minutes, he would plug his foolscap-sized newspad into the ship's information circuit and scan the latest reports from Earth. One by one, he would conjure up the world's major electronic papers. He knew the codes of the more important ones by heart and had no need to consult the list on the back of his pad. Switching to the display unit's short-term memory, he would hold the front page while he quickly searched the headlines and noted the items that interested him. Each had its own two-digit reference. When he punched that, the postage-stamp-sized rectangle would expand until it neatly filled the screen and he could read it with comfort. When he had finished, he would flash back to the complete page and select a new subject for detailed examination. Floyd sometimes wondered if the newspad, and the fantastic technology behind it, was the last word in man's quest for perfect communications. Here he was, far out in space, speeding away from Earth at thousands of miles an hour, yet in a few milliseconds he could see the headlines of any newspaper he pleased. That very word, newspaper, of course, was an anachronistic hangover into the age of electronics. The text was updated automatically on every hour. If one read only the English versions, one could spend an entire lifetime doing nothing but absorbing the ever-changing flow of information from the news satellites. It was hard to imagine how the system could be improved or made more convenient. But sooner or later, Floyd guessed, it would pass away, to be replaced by something as unimaginable as the newspad itself would have been to Caxton or Gutenberg. There was another thought which a scanning of those tiny electronic headlines often invoked. The more wonderful the means of communication, the more trivial, tawdry, or depressing its contents seemed to be. Accidents, crimes, natural and man-made disasters, threats of conflict, gloomy editorials, these still seem to be the main concern of the millions of words being sprayed into the ether. Yet Floyd also wondered if this was altogether a bad thing. The newspapers of Utopia, he had long ago decided, would be terribly dull. From time to time, the captain and the other members of the crew came into the cabin and exchanged a few words with him. They treated their distinguished passenger with awe, and were doubtless burning with curiosity about his mission, but were too polite to ask any questions or even to drop any hints. Only the charming little stewardess seemed completely at ease in his presence. As Floyd quickly discovered, she came from Bali, and had carried beyond the atmosphere some of the grace and mystery of that still largely unspoiled island. One of his strangest and most enchanting memories of the entire trip was her zero-gravity demonstration of some classical Balinese dance movements, with the lovely blue-green crescent of the waning earth as a backdrop. There was one sleep period when the main cabin lights were switched off, and Floyd fastened down his arms and legs with the elastic sheets that would prevent him from drifting away into space. It seemed a crude arrangement, but here in zero gravity his unpadded couch was more comfortable than the most luxurious mattress on Earth. When he had strapped himself in, Floyd dozed off quickly enough, but woke up once in a drowsy, half-conscious condition to be completely baffled by his strange surroundings. For a moment he thought that he was in the middle of some dimly lit Chinese lantern. The faint glow from the other cubicles around him gave that impression. Then he said to himself, firmly and successfully, "Go to sleep, boy. This is just an ordinary moon shuttle." When he awoke, the moon had swallowed up half the sky, and the braking maneuvers were about to begin. The wide arc of windows set in the curving wall of the passenger section now looked out onto the open sky, not the approaching globe, so he moved into the control cabin. Here, on the rear-view TV screen, he could watch the final stages of the descent. The approaching lunar mountains were utterly unlike those of Earth. They lacked the dazzling caps of snow, the green, close-fitting garments of vegetation, the moving crowns of cloud. Nevertheless, the fierce contrasts of light and shadow gave them a strange beauty of their own. The laws of earthly aesthetics did not apply here. This world had been shaped and molded by other than terrestrial forces, operating over eons of time unknown to the young, verdant Earth, with its fleeting ice ages, its swiftly rising and falling seas, its mountain ranges dissolving like mists before the dawn. Here was age inconceivable, but not death, for the moon had never lived until now. The descending ship was poised almost above the line dividing night from day, and directly below was a chaos of jagged shadows and brilliant isolated peaks catching the first light of the slow lunar dawn. That would be a fearful place to attempt a landing, even with all possible electronic aids, but they were slowly drifting away from it, toward the night side of the moon. Then Floyd saw, as his eyes grew more accustomed to the fainter illumination, that the night land was not wholly dark. It was aglow with a ghostly light, in which peaks and valleys and plains could be clearly seen. The earth, a giant moon to the moon, was flooding the land below with its radiance. On the pilot's panel, lights flashed above radar screens, numbers came and went on computer displays, clocking off the distance of the approaching moon. They were still more than 1,000 miles away when weight returned as the jets began their gentle but steady deceleration. For ages, it seemed, the moon slowly expanded across the sky. The sun sank below the horizon, and at last a single giant crater filled the field of view. The shuttle was falling toward its central peaks, and suddenly Floyd noticed that near one of those peaks a brilliant light was flashing with a regular rhythm. It might have been an airport beacon back on Earth, and he stared at it with a tightening of the throat. It was proof that men had established another foothold on the moon. Now, the crater had expanded so much that its ramparts were slipping below the horizon, and the smaller craterlets that peppered its interior were beginning to disclose their real size. Some of these, tiny though they had seemed from far out in space, were miles across and could have swallowed whole cities. Under its automatic controls, the shuttle was sliding down the starlit sky toward that barren landscape glimmering in the light of the great gibbous earth. Now a voice was calling somewhere above the whistle of the jets and the electronic beepings that came and went through the cabin.
Clavius Control to Special 14. You're coming in nicely. Please make manual check of landing gear lock, hydraulic pressure, shock pad inflation.
The pilot pressed sundry switches. Green lights flashed and he called back.
All manual checks completed. Landing gear lock, hydraulic pressure, shock pad okay.
Confirmed,
said the moon, and the descent continued wordlessly. Though there was still plenty of talking, it was all being done by machines, flashing binary impulses to one another at 1,000 times the rate their slow-thinking makers could communicate. Some of the mountain peaks were already towering above the shuttle. Now the ground was only a few 1,000 feet away, and the beacon light was a brilliant star, flashing steadily above a group of low buildings and odd vehicles. In the final stage of the descent, the jets seemed to be playing some strange tune. They pulsed on and off, making the last fine adjustments to the thrust. Abruptly, a swirling cloud of dust hid everything. The jets gave one final spurt, and the shuttle rocked very slightly, like a rowboat when a small wave goes by. It was some minutes before Floyd could really accept the silence that now enfolded him and the weak gravity that gripped his limbs. He had made, utterly without incident and in little more than one day, the incredible journey of which men had dreamed for 2,000 years. After a normal, routine flight, he had landed on the moon. Chapter 10. Clavius Base. Clavius, 150 miles in diameter, is the second largest crater on the visible face of the moon and lies in the center of the southern highlands. It is very old. Ages of volcanism and bombardment from space have scarred its walls and pockmarked its floor. But since the last era of crater formation, when the debris from the asteroid belt was still battering the inner planets, it had known peace for 500 million years. Now there were new, strange stirrings on and below its surface, for here man was establishing his first permanent bridgehead on the moon. Clavius Base could, in an emergency, be entirely self-supporting. All the necessities of life were produced from the local rocks, after they had been crushed, heated, and chemically processed. Hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, all these and most of the other elements could be found inside the moon, if one knew where to look for them. The base was a closed system, like a tiny working model of Earth itself, recycling all the chemicals of life. The atmosphere was purified in a vast hothouse, a large circular room buried just below the lunar surface. Under blazing lamps by night and filtered sunlight by day, acres of stubby green plants grew in a warm, moist atmosphere. They were special mutations designed for the express purpose of replenishing the air with oxygen and providing food as a byproduct. More food was produced by chemical processing systems and algae culture. Although the green scum circulating through yards of transparent plastic tubes would scarcely have appealed to a gourmet, the biochemists could convert it into chops and steaks only an expert could distinguish from the real thing. The 1,100 men and 600 women who made up the personnel of the base were all highly trained scientists or technicians, carefully selected before they had left Earth. Though lunar living was now virtually free from the hardships, disadvantages, and occasional dangers of the early days, it was still psychologically demanding and not recommended for anyone suffering from claustrophobia. Since it was expensive and time-consuming to cut a large underground base out of solid rock or compacted lava, the standard one-man living module was a room only about 6 feet wide, 10 feet long, and 8 feet high. Each room was attractively furnished and looked very much like a good motel suite, with convertible sofa, TV, small hi-fi set, and vision phone. Moreover, by a simple trick of interior decoration,
The one unbroken wall could be converted by the flip of a switch into a convincing terrestrial landscape. There was a choice of 8 views. This touch of luxury was typical of the base, though it was sometimes hard to explain its necessity to the folk back on Earth. Every man and woman in Clavius had cost $100,000 in training and transport and housing. It was worth a little extra to maintain their peace of mind.